Hello and welcome to Test Coast Games, the podcast about tabletop games from a West Coast perspective. I'm one of your hosts, Mark USA. I'd like to welcome back my co-host, Mark Ellis. How are you doing, Mark?
Hi there, Mark. Yeah, doing pretty good, thanks. Christmas around the corner. I think for once I've done my shopping with over a week to spare, so that is a relief. How about you?
Yeah, I took care of that stuff well in advance, thankfully, with the help of my wife. She's always a good planner. So all set, coast is clear, just got to get through this last week of work.
I know that feeling, yeah.
Leaves more time for games-related activities, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We've just been discussing how Christmas can hinder playtesting, so yeah, it'd be nice to get into the new year.
Yeah, I'm hoping there'll be more time with a little bit of time off from people. But enough talk about all that fun holiday stuff. We're very fortunate today to have a special guest with us. Today, we're happy to speak to Jay Cormier, Vancouver-based game designer of Belfort, In the Hall of the Mountain King, Junk Art, and the forthcoming Mind Management, among many, many more titles. Welcome, Jay, to the show.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Hey, I'm great. Great. Today's a great day. Today's my work from home day, which is always highlights of my week.
Yeah, Jay, you know, I got to say, I'm really happy that you're finally on the show. You're actually, you know, one of the first people I thought of when even starting this podcast about games related things in the West Coast. Always have you at the top of mind when it comes to game design and game designers.
Nice. Hey, glad to be here.
So I just got to say, I recently listened to your interview on the Indie Board Game Designers podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I really recommend that to anyone else listening for some more of your background and some of the way you work. It was a great listen.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
But for our show, you know, we like to do something a little bit different, trying to get to know more about you, maybe from the personal side or some things people haven't heard before.
Great. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So we're going to skip over the background questions and jump into some meaty things that I would certainly like to know about.
I think, you know, the first question that came to our minds was one that's close to both of our hearts because we've been working on a co-design together. And so the question is, you know, you yourself, Jay, you've worked most often in design partnerships with your long-term design partner, Sen Fung Lim, of course.
Mm-hmm.
As well as more recently, you've been working with Shad Miller, Graham Yarns, and Chase Disher.
Yeah.
We were wondering, how do you find working solo compared with working with a partner? Are there particular advantages one way or the other?
Oh, there is so many advantages for working with a partner, and there's only one advantage for working on your own. The one advantage working on your own is you get 100% of the royalties instead of 50%.
Right.
That's the only advantage of working on your own. It is. It literally is. That's the only advantage. Working with a partner gives you so many other benefits. It's like everything from it depends if you're in the same city, which sometimes I'm not. Like with Shad and with Sen, they live in different cities. And so that one of the benefits there is we have totally different playtest groups. That's huge. That's twice as much playtesting we can get done as a partnership. That's fantastic. It really speeds up the process.
Right, and you get different perspectives too, I would imagine.
100%, yeah. You can't just playtest with the same groups, or you're just going to get that kind of tunnel vision of your group's likes and dislikes. So that's a huge thing. And then, of course, just the other big aspect is motivation. And I find with a partnership that when one person is waning in motivation, it's sometimes the other partner, can pick up that and kind of keep the ball going when you're kind of lost and whatnot. So it's if you don't have someone to do that, to either bounce ideas off of or someone who can just carry the ball for a little while, then it just falls when you're just by yourself and you pick it up maybe sometime later, maybe sometimes you don't if you're on your own.
Yeah, that sounds a very big advantage.
Mm-hmm.
We know that you've been working with Sen Fung Lim for a long time, and I think you and he were working together for some of your earliest designs.
Yeah.
I'd like to know, how did you guys make your initial contacts in the industry then? You know, how did you break in, so to speak?
So our first game was signed about almost 10 years ago. Maybe even signed 10 years ago, actually. And back then, there was hardly any support for game designers with regards to online stuff. Like, there was no information out there and, like, steps and Jamie Stegmaier's steps on how to kickstart. Kickstart wasn't even around. Didn't have, like, just nothing. So we were literally trying to make it up, and we had no idea what to do at all, which I think is the case for most people that haven't really done their research. They just have no idea what to do next. We just figured, I don't even know how we knew this, we just figured, like, we should go to one of these conventions And the convention we chose for some reason was Gamma, which is super weird. But it was because it was in Vegas and I'm in Vancouver. So it's like, wasn't that, you know, big of a trip or commitment. And so at the time we're like, okay, we had upwards of six games that we wanted to pitch. And for some reason I think it was through the fact that my day job involves working with in the electronics world, like consumer electronics. And I see a lot of like sales sheets for consumer electronics. And I thought we should make something like this for our games to make it easier for us to kind of pitch games when we go to talk to publishers, of which would be 100% cold calling into their booth at the time, because I had no idea how to even contact somebody, let alone figure that out. So we designed and we're claiming we invented the sales sheet for board games because we had never seen it before. And yeah, we made them up. And I myself went to Gamma and walked around to booths and just like, hi, are you looking for games right now? And you can see that the reaction went from like, hi, to, oh, you're a designer. And they kind of went down a bit because I think they really wanted me to be a retailer that was going to buy a whole bunch of their games. But then when I pulled up my sales sheets, they all of a sudden perked up. They're like, oh, this is, you're kind of serious. You've done some work and you're presenting yourself very nicely. So that's part of the main reason why we still do the sales sheets today, actually.
I had no idea that you, sir, were responsible for the board game industry sales sheet. It's a big claim.
It seems weird for me to claim it, but all I'll say is that I literally never heard of it or seen it before that we used it. So whether somebody else had it already and was using it, I have no idea. But we just came up with this idea of like, we should do this.
I'll back you up if anyone asks. No, it's incredibly important having the sales sheet. You started a trend because so many people are doing it. We just had recently a pitching session with a bunch of publishers at around the Shucks event.
Yeah.
You personally helped me a great deal by looking over my sales sheet.
Right.
Listening to a pitch at GAC at the Game Artisans event in Vancouver. And, I got to thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem.
Of course, you have the experience to know, what it takes.
I mean, I've been in the industry for over 10 years now, and we still make sales sheets. So it's not like it's just for newbies or something like that. It still has value for me, even 10 years on, even with the relationships I have with publishers now, I still do sales sheets.
It's incredibly valuable. And just these past few months, I've been designing, a new small game for the Button Shy contests.
Nice.
You know about those?
Yeah.
It's an 18 card game thing. And I've gotten the chance to do three games in 3 months and three sales sheets to go along with them. So I'm getting the practice in.
That's awesome.
So thank you for starting that trend.
Cool.
I should chime in and add my own thanks as well, Jay. You gave feedback to myself and a number of others in the build up to that pitching event. So
My pleasure.
We were learning from the master, unbeknownst to us. Well,
I don't know about master, but at least, originator. Let's just call it that, at least. Yeah. I've seen some pretty nice looking sales sheets out there. Mine are very perfunctory. Right? They do the job, but they're not necessarily pretty.
That's the absolute key, though, isn't it? Get that information in there, make it clear.
Yeah, as a side note, just it's a weird plug, but it's associated, so that's why I feel okay saying it. But for people that sign up to www.failfaster.ca's newsletter, they'll be sent free immediately a 16-page e-guide on how to create your own sales sheet, including five samples of sales sheets that I use for my games that actually ended up getting signed.
Ooh, that's an excellent time to mention that. We were, I believe, going to come onto the Fail Faster Journal a little bit later. Yeah. So we can talk about that in a little more detail later on, but that's an excellent reason to sign up for sure.
Oh, cool.
Another question we had for you, Jay, was around your wide variety of games that you've designed. We've got, on the one hand, we've got dexterity games like Junk Arts, ranging across to drawing party games, such as Draw Your Own Conclusions, which is one of your solo designs more recently. Mm-hmm. You've got tile laying in your arsenal with Acroteri and Complexity, among others. So where do your ideas come from, and how does a new idea start out for you?
Well, I think like many people that are inclined to be designers or even just creative people, everything is an idea, and you just start getting the ideas themselves aren't the hard part, really. It's turning it into something unique. That's the hard part. We've had games originate from a mechanic, some from a theme, some from a title. We started with a title. Like, this is a cool title, like Train of Thought. Sen literally was typing something. He's like, here's a weird train of thought, as he was talking in some other game, blah, blah, blah. And then he put brackets. That's actually a neat name for a game, Train of Thought. And then we made a game. It got published called Train of Thought. So it sometimes even from a component, this is a cool component. What can we do with this? And a game comes out based on that. So that's not the issue. But the issue is, and this is kind of our caveat, and mine for sure, and for sure I know Sen's, is trying to do something unique with it such that it warrants existing. Because there's too many games out there right now. Not too many. That's the wrong way to say that. There's so many games. There's never too many games. Bring them all. More games, please. But there's so many games out there that you have to do something special to stand out. You have to either have something clever in your mechanics. They're like, oh, that's neat. That's a cool way of doing that. Or something just totally different and whatnot. So we've prided ourselves on trying to continue to delve into different mechanics. And we don't just stay in one kind of, you know, wheelhouse. You pointed out a whole bunch, but like even something like Rock, Paper, Wizard, which actually uses hand gestures as a mechanic. We just kind of keep trying to come up with different things to make all of our games feel like they're unique entities.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can fault you for designing the same game over and over again. You know, I was encouraged to hear on another podcast, I think you said you had something like 6 games ready to go before you signed your first one.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's really encouraging.
Yeah.
Shows that, you know, if you put the work in, you know, you'll get a good result out.
Let's see, out of all those, I'd have to go back, but I bet you only one of those 6 ever got, no, 2 of them, 2 of those 6 got signed. 4 of them just never did.
Yeah, there you go. You have to shoot wide and, you know, see what the market is willing to bear at the time.
And it's interesting because it actually came from a bit of practicality, because that first time I went to Gamma, all 6 of the games I brought got interest from at least one publisher, which was super exciting. None of them got picked up that year, by the way. They're all rejected, which is totally fine. But I remember because I was cold calling from booth to booth, which I don't recommend anyone to do nowadays, but that's all I knew how to do back then. I would go up to a booth, I would look at a booth, and then I would try to reorder my sales sheets in the order that I think would appeal to that publisher before going up to them saying, hey, blah, blah, blah. And that's something I still do to today, where I try to make sure the games that are more relevant to them are show up first. But there's a few times where I didn't have anything for the publisher at all. We didn't have a kids game, or we didn't have a party game, or there's something we were missing. And so Sen and I would deliberately try to fill those holes for the next convention we were going to. We're like, okay, by this time, when we go to this convention next, we don't have these kind of games. We better make one. It allows us to talk to pretty much every publisher there if we have a game for everybody.
Nice. That's really good advice for designers starting out in the industry to maybe branch out and try a few different things and tune them to match the publisher in mind, because we all know publishers have different styles and different tastes.
Now, that said, the flip side, I've shot myself in the foot before where I've literally said to a publisher as I'm going through my sales sheets, I'm like, oh, this game isn't for you, and flipping next. And they're like, well, just tell us what it is. And I tell it to them and they're like, that's kind of interesting. And then that publisher ended up signing it, the one I said, this isn't for you. So you never know exactly what a publisher is looking for, or if they're thinking about branching out into a different kind of line of types of products. So you never know. But prioritizing them makes sense. Just don't say stupid things like I did.
More good advice. So, you know, we've talked about the variety of your game designs, but, you know, I have noticed something personally about your games is that a lot of them have some sort of spatial or geometric aspect to them. A lot of them uses grids or, you know, polyominoes, tiles, connecting tiles. So is that a conscious choice? And, you know, what drives that part of your designs? Is it yourself, Sen, something the both of you share?
I don't think it's conscious. I think Sen and I always try to, one of our mantras is trying to get the game to the table as soon as possible. And what that means is, like, instead of designing the entire game and spending months on the game design and then finally making a prototype and then testing it for the first time, that's not the way to do it. You should be, oh, what's the term? Failing faster. And trying to get a prototype to the table as soon as possible, which means that it's going to be very bare bones and it's going to be very minimalist. And sometimes when it's minimalist, you're using very basic things like, you know, basic colors, basic shapes. And that sometimes gets you an idea of if there's a fun element in here or not. So maybe it comes from that. I do know that I personally love tiling games. And so maybe I unconsciously have kind of like created some spatial type games, maybe.
for sure, Belfort has got a bit of it because Aram George Akrotiri. Junkart's obviously spatial.
Yeah, even in the Hall of the Mountain King,
oh, of course, yeah, absolutely.
This is Scott Rogers, the designer of Pandone the Game, and you are listening to the Test Coast Games podcast.
We're just going to move on slightly away from design now, perhaps, to talk about your recent move into publishing.
Woohoo!
Of course, with Off the Page Games. So this is a very exciting move for you, I would imagine. And so we're very interested to know, what are your hopes for Off the Page Games? And what are the major challenges on this journey?
Well, it's surprising even to me, because for the longest time, so many friends not in the industry would always say, why don't you just publish yourself? Why don't you go on Dragon's Den or Shark Tank and just ask for money, and then you can make all this money for yourself? And our response was like, we're not interested in that. That's not something we just like designing games. I don't want to be stuck in publisher hell and figuring all this background stuff. And this past year, I came up with this idea for a playtesting journal for game designers called the Fail Faster Journal. And I decided to put that on Kickstarter because it felt like a really neat idea based on the feedback I was getting from the local Game Artisans Canada group here in Vancouver. I had a kind of modest target of $7,000 to help pay for it all. Ended up hitting, I think, $38,000. So I was really happy with that. And it's continuing to sell now. I'm continuing to sell it to various sources around the world, which is very exciting. So that alone started making me comfortable with Kickstarter, because that was a very easy-ish project to manage for as a first-time Kickstarter project, because even though there were stretch goals, it was all self-contained within the journal. So that started at least getting me in, you know, talking to manufacturers in China, talking about shipping and figuring all that stuff out. So I've got some experience under my belt, even though board games is a whole new beast. And then we designed this game called Mind Management, Sen and I, and based on pretty much my favorite comic in the last 20 years, guaranteed it's my favorite comic in the last 20 years, and super exciting to be able to partner with the creator and artist, Matt Kint, with this game. And just, it's been an amazing thing. If you can ever imagine one of your favorite things and all of a sudden you're now able to contribute to the world of that thing, it's just truly awesome, and I'm very excited about it. So we pitched that to a publisher more than a year ago, and it got signed, and we're all like, there you go, good stuff, let us know when it comes out. And we went back to designing, and then I don't know, 8 months later that publisher went under, so they folded up, and we got the rights back to the game. And so then we had a meeting and we're like, so what do we do now? Like, we got to now repitch it. And how are we going to do that? Who are we going to go talk to? And it was actually Matt Kint who says, like, well, why don't we just do it ourselves, guys? He's like, I'm the artist. I can do all the art, and my background is graphic design. I can do that too. And you just publish it. And so I had to take that one away and kind of think about it. And some background on me: for the last 3 years, my day job, that of which I've been working at the same company for 23 years now, they let me go down to part-time to help me focus 2 days a week. I'm at home working at home on game design stuff, which is amazing. I'd love it to go to full-time, but hey, one step at a time. So now that I partnered with that information, that I have more time now, and that fact that we have this opportunity to bring this game to life and kind of have even more control over it than I'm giving it to a publisher, I thought about it, and I talked to Sen. I said, Sen, would you mind if I was the publisher by myself? Because Sen's got a full-time job. So I just tried to figure out the, you know, logistics of balancing that and working that out. He's like, no, you go for it. So I did it. I started up a company. And the last kind of kick the can was like, well, what do I call myself? I had the Fail Faster brand kind of working, but I'm like, that does not sound like a good name for a publisher. So I came up with the name Off the Page Games because I figured a nice kind of niche might be to only publish games that are based off of comic books. It's a little selfish, so I'm hoping I'll be able to work with a lot of my heroes in the comic book world.
I mean, that sounds like a fantastic plan, and you know, that could well pay off in future. I think that the name is very catchy and immediately, you know, tells the story of what that brand is going to be. So
I think also I'm hoping that it also elicits that off the page, where something jumps off the page at you, and it maybe says table presence is the kind of another visual that I'm going for with that name.
Yeah, I was watching your recent video of your video channel, which we should also promote, that Off the Page Games is a YouTube channel,
mm-hmm.
which has quite a few video episodes now covering, basically, it's like a video documentary of the starting of your company and the publishing of a game. So it's really exciting stuff.
Yeah, with maybe a little bit of hubris, I decided to call it How to Start a Board Game Company, which is not exactly true. It's how I'm starting a board game company, which may probably isn't the right way to do it, but it's what I'm doing. So it's more, you're correct. It's more of a documentary on what I'm doing, but I'm always open to feedback and pokes if people have ideas.
No, it's great. You're covering a lot of ground, even from doing the books to Kickstarter promos. I saw a recent one you talked with the Indie Game Alliance, which was really valuable to get some
insight. Yeah, that was wild. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I learned a lot. I think you learned a lot. It was great.
I timed it perfectly because I literally didn't know anything about it. So I learned as much as anybody who watched the video learned.
Perfect. So in your recent video, you were talking to Matt Kent. And speaking of off the page, you're trying to sort of integrate the comic book panels into even the potentially the rule books.
Yeah, it's a fine line that we're trying to tread. And Matt, fortunately, is on the same page as me in that in our marketing and advertising for this game, we're really not going to call out that it's based on a comic book. I have a mindset that I think that will actually alienate some people. And it's happened to me where I see something based on the hit TV show or something. I'm like, I have no idea what that is. I'll pass because obviously it's not for me is what I feel like sometimes. I think people that know of the title know that it's based on a comic and get excited no matter what. You don't have to tell them it's based on a comic.
Well, as the designer of the Orphan Black the card game and the Godfather dice game, I think you'd have some experience with licenses, so you know whereof you speak.
And well, we have the D&D is Rock Paper Wizard, that's licensed, and we have a Godzilla game coming out and two more huge IPs coming out next year that we can't mention yet, but huge, super exciting.
I do want to remind people again to go check out Off the Page Games on YouTube because it's really valuable.
Oh, cool.
Especially for people starting out in the design industry.
Half of me is like when we started getting our game published, we started writing a blog on bamboozlebrothers.com. And there's a little button up there called The Steps. And if you click on that, it literally will detail all the steps Sen and I took to get our games published. Every single step. So Sen and I have always been transparent and always very trying to help others in the industry in any way we can. And there's really no, you know, reason. It's just, we just like doing it. And so when I started this company, I was a similar thing. I'm like, well, what can I do now? I'm like, well, I guess I'll talk about this new experience I'm going through and that'll be my new thing. And so that's kind of the reason behind that.
It's incredibly valuable what, you know, you and other prominent designers, well-liked designers in the industry do is that they give back. Yourself, Jamie Stegmaier, which you mentioned, there's Gabe from the Board Game Design Lab, so many people like helping, sharing, and giving back. And, you know, that's why it really feels like a welcoming industry to get into.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting into the industry and helping each other out, I know you well as an active member of the Game Artisans of Canada.
Yeah.
We recently had Eric Araue, who is a fellow member of yours. We got a lot of background on what exactly GAC is, but I wanted to find out from you, what do you get out of GAC? You know, what does it mean to you?
Oh, it is my favorite night of the week, Tuesday nights. I'm not even joking. It's like, I'm so excited about it. The ability to have a consistent and frequent game testing group alone, just that alone is amazing, and it's the envy of many other designers that I know of, that they are envious that we have a group, let alone the fact that we meet every week. Some don't even have that once a month. And so to me, it's just so vital, because as we all know as designers, for those that are listening that are designers, the biggest bottleneck on design is playtesting. And so the fact that I can get something tested every week and then go back and iterate and then maybe bring it back and test it again, it's just amazing. And the fact that these are all design-minded people brings a different type of insight. And we've kind of groomed the group to be people that are okay with giving their feedback openly and people that can receive that feedback openly. So no punches are withheld, and I mean that in a loving way. Nobody's punching or even being mean. Everybody is supporting, and everyone has the same goal. How can we make this game better? And so it's just a great net. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't playtest with other people and non-designers, but playtesting with a group of other game designers is super valuable.
I think for my personal growth, I'm just coming to realize that myself, that I have to playtest more. Like going weekly is a great thing, and GAC can help you do that. Even just being there as a, what do you call them, friends of GAC, as someone who comes to test, not necessarily test their own games, to see you guys in work, hear the kind of conversations that you guys have as experienced designers is certainly valuable to me.
Yeah, it's highly recommended. And anybody that's listening to this, by any chance, across Canada, there's chapters in a lot of the cities across Canada. So I don't even know how you would search for us anymore, because we used to have a website, but I think it's now kind of gone down. But maybe on Facebook, I think there's a GAC group, but it might be closed. I'm not even sure how you reach us anymore.
Yeah, I think Eric shared with us an email, so I'll make sure to put that into the show notes.
Hey, cool. But it's great for the what we use it for, and even allowing more members to come in, and how we have that process, which I'm sure Eric detailed, being our steward for Vancouver. That's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, it's a real ground up organization.
I know, Jay, another string to your bow is you teach game design at the Vancouver Film School. Mark and I are wondering, what is the first lesson you teach your students when they're turning up fresh faced and eager to learn about their first steps in that world?
For context, these are students that are enrolled in a video game design program, and then one of their classes is on game theory and analog game design. And some of them, and in my first few times I taught this, I was kind of like smacked around a bit, because I didn't provide enough context about why this class is important to video game designers. And so now I spend the first little bit of my class, the very first class, talking about this, have them brainstorm ideas like, why the heck are we talking about board games in a video game class? And they kind of convince themselves through a facilitated discussion. Plus I show a 5-minute video from the extra credits, kind of cartoon animated videos about that exact topic. And it kind of cinches the deal. But then the first class is all about going through various mechanics and how roll and move is one way you can get people to move. But we teach mechanics in a very different way. We talk about how in mechanics you have a purpose and an implementation. And so the purpose, we talked about the fact that in most games, there's probably around 5 different things you're going to be doing. You're going to be moving in some games. You're going to be attacking in some games. You're going to be exploring in some. You're going to be building or gathering resources in some. And you're going to be gaining control. And so if that's the purpose, how are the different ways you can implement this? And because it's video games, I start off by talking about move. In video games, there's tons of movement. How are the different ways you can move your character or move around in a video game? And even that, there's so many different ways you can move around. Obviously, using a controller stick is one way, using keys on a keyboard, using a mouse to click where you want to go, all sorts of different ways you can move. And same with board games. It's not just dice, because majority of people students that come into the class, their experience with board games is very limited and or very kind of family friendly games that they grew up on, like we all did, like the Monopolies and Clues and all that kind of stuff, and not knocking them, but that's all they know. And so they don't know that there's other ways you can move around a board than rolling dice. And that's just starting to open the doors for them on all the different things that they can do in the world of board games.
Right. I think that that's starting to change now that board games, of course, originally influenced video games, but now video games skyrocketed up. And now it seems that finally board games are starting to influence video games again with things like Slay the Spire, Hearthstone. So many tabletop inspired mechanisms are working their way back into video games. And
absolutely,
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of video game designers are purposely reaching out and trying to find resources about tabletop to inform themselves. We were fortunate enough to have on Scott Rogers of Ludology a few episodes ago. Of course, he's taught at lots of universities over the years in California, wrote a couple of great game design books, and you know, he lives in both worlds and he totally lives and breathes it. And he would certainly echo your points about, he called it the first action, the motivating action that leads all designs. You know, you're Pac-Man, you're moving around, you have to move, or you're Solid Snake and you have to sneak.
Mm-hmm.
It's right in the first action you take, and that motivates everything.
Cool.
Very much on point there. So after creating so many games, you really have too many to mention. Go check out your go check out your page on Board Game Geek. But is there a grail game that you have always wanted to design, or maybe you have designed and you just haven't gotten it published yet?
The IP grail is Indiana Jones, as I stare and look at my office filled with Indiana Jones memorabilia merchandise. But the game idea would be some sort of time traveling game, because there are some out there, but I find a lot of them very, I don't feel very time travel-y in them. So something, some sort of time travel game would be cool without making it so convoluted and complicated. And of course, the Grail game for everybody, I think, not everybody, but anybody who wants to kind of make a career out of game design is evergreen. Just get a game that it becomes evergreen, which means it's selling all the time in all the stores.
Oh, that's easier said than done, right?
Oh, it's impossible. It's so hard. It's like saying, "Oh, just write a top 10 best-selling novel." That's all I want to do.
Yeah, there's no formula out there for that, is there? I wouldn't have thought. No. I mean, even I've heard stories. I believe with Code Names, for example, I believe that was one that the designer Vlada Schwarzschild didn't have much faith in initially.
No, and I was fortunate enough to be able to test a demo of that when we went to this group gathering called the Gathering of Friends, and it was just a kind of in a cardboard box, and it was already the hit of the con, and it really motivated CGE, the company who published it, to like, you know, make a go of it.
Oh, there's so many iterations of that game now in Target and major retailers all around. There's Disney, there's Marvel, there's The Simpsons, I think.
Yep. The challenge I find with that is that I was going to buy Marvel for my friend, but I'm like, nobody will be able to play that with him. Like, he's the smartest Marvel guy. So, like, you can only play with a group of friends that all know that IP well.
So, do you have particular plans for future game-related projects, ones that you're able to share with us, Jay? I know you mentioned you've got a couple that are in the works that sound very exciting that you can't speak about yet.
Yeah, I have a couple of I can say they're like adventure escapey room in a box kind of games that are based on IPs that I'm really excited about. One's all sealed and done and you know, boxed up and should be coming soon-ish, sometime next year, and the other one is still just being tested, but so excited about those two. A Godzilla game, card game, coming from WizKids hopefully next year. That I've been working on for a long time. That could be cool because it's kind of like, can't call it a living card game because I think Fantasy Flight has that kind of branding. But it's that kind of idea where, you know, it's a full set, but you can mix and match and make your own decks afterwards. And then I just came up with a new party game just recently, like this week, last week with Shad. And I'm super excited about it. I tested it out last week at the GAC meeting, and it was super fun and really awesome. So I'm curious to see if round two goes well tomorrow.
Yeah, sign me up for Godzilla. I'll be first hour backer for that one. That sounds great.
Nice.
And another reason to go to GAC is that you get to see some of these great ideas in their infancy.
Mm-hmm. And shape them and help kind of form and, you know, give feedback on how to make them better.
Yeah, it's super exciting. So Jay, we're about to round out the show, but we want to ask you this question that we ask a lot of our guests.
Mm-hmm.
So Jay, what non-gaming subject or person inspires you the most?
You know, on one hand, I'd say Steve Martin from a person perspective, and that's because he's someone that when he was the best comedian in the world, he stopped doing it, and then he started doing film. And not just because he just started doing film, but he was doing fine in film, and then he started writing plays. And then all the while he's doing banjo, and then he's got a band where he does plays a banjo in a band and wins Grammys and whatnot. Like, he's just so well-rounded and so always trying different things, and feels like I could relate to someone like that who's always desperately trying to figure out how am I going to stay creative and what's going to challenge me and motivate me to do something different.
Yeah, his track record is pretty impressive. And I don't know if this was the case earlier in his career, but when you listen to interviews with him now, it seems like he's a really sort of humble, kind of introspective guy who really just wants to learn and keep learning.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually did his master class as a stand up comedian because I just wanted to hear how he processed everything.
You know, I really thought you were going to say comic books because you said that was something that inspired you to kick off the page.
Well, I mean, if I had another half hour, I would talk about all sorts of media. Like, I'm a huge movie buff. That would probably be the top thing. Like, I love so many movies, foreign movies, horror movies, crazy, weird sci-fi. Like, I love movies so much. And my wife is just amazed at the fact that I know directors, writers of various movies from, you know, 40 years ago. And she's like, how do you know that? I'm like, I don't even know what I had for breakfast yesterday, but I remember that. Movie. And then yes, comic books. I've definitely slid off the comic book thing. I used to be super huge into comic books. It's just super hard to stay in the rhythm nowadays. And the fact reading them is really hard for me now with having two kids. Finding the time to sit down and just read a comic book is harder for me right now. But I still love them, and I still buy them more in the trade format now so that I could at least read them all in kind of one go instead of monthly.
It sounds like there might be an opportunity to weave those into story time in future. I don't know. Kids might need to be a bit older.
But, yes. For the kind of comics I like, yes.
Yeah, there's some pretty good kids comics and books these days.
I can't wait to jump into that.
Nice. I have some recommendations for you after the show.
Oh, please, please.
So to round out, we wondered whether you have any shout-outs you'd like to make, Jay. We've mentioned, for example, the Fail Faster Journal, which I have to say, you know, I've got one on the table next to me. I know Mark owns a copy as well. In fact, I think we put in an order for about 10 copies total for our little playtest group. So I can highly recommend that. It is full of fantastic pro tips is one aspect I really like. We've got, you know, different advice on every page, which keeps you thinking about how you should be approaching your playtest, which is very useful.
And if you live in Vancouver, you can pick them up at Rainy City Games. They've stocked them and supply at both their locations, so that's pretty cool. Otherwise, you can order them, you know, from GameCrafter.com online.
Rainy City Games is great to see it on the shelf there, and congratulations again on the huge success of that Kickstarter.
Thanks.
I never would have guessed that was your route into Off the Page. That's, you know, that it showed you publisher hell was not so bad as all that.
Yeah, and it's kind of like the Steve Martin thing. It was just another, like, okay, I'm kind of doing, you know, game design is always challenging. It's always doing every single game. As long as you're always trying to make different games, I find it's always challenging and interesting. So I hope and I don't think I'll ever tire of game design. But this was just another challenge of like, okay, let's run a publisher now. Let's be that. And it's all lots of learning.
And kudos to you for taking that on. It sure is a big challenge. And yeah, I hope that goes from strength to strength.
Thank you.
We got to mention the Off the Page Games YouTube channel again.
Yep.
Well worth checking out. So much more advice and you know, background into what you're doing currently with your new game designs, and particularly mind management, which is, it sounds like it's really taking shape. Can you remind us again when that is going to Kickstarter? It hasn't gone yet, right?
Yeah, no, it hasn't gone yet. That'll be in early March this coming year, 2020. And it's a one versus many game. So if you like those kind of games, like hidden movement type games, based on that hit comic book that I love so much.
Oh, that's great. So listeners will have plenty of time to look forward to that in the new year.
Right on.
Well, I've really had a lot of fun talking to you, Jay, learning a lot more about yourself, and glad we got to cover such a wide range of fun topics.
Oh, thank you so much, Marks.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jay. It's been a pleasure to learn a bit more about your inspirations and your sort of journey through game design.
My pleasure.
Great. Well, we'll hope you'll grace the show again. Give us some of your Vancouver West Coast game designer wisdom.
Anytime, guys.
Thanks so much. Well, for the Test Coast Games podcast, I've been Mark Uessa, and my co-host.
And I've been Mark Ellis.
Great. Thanks so much, Jay, and we'll talk to you really soon at the GAC.
Bye-bye.
Reach out to us at testcoastgames@gmail.com. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/testcoast or send us a tip at ko-fi.com/testcoast. And rate and review us on iTunes so we can reach even more listeners. Our intro song is Day One by Declan DP, courtesy of the Internet Archive. Featuring Summertime by Scandinavians, courtesy of theartistunion.com. Additional music courtesy of dig.ccmixter.org and bensound.com. Please see our show notes for more details. Our outro song is Nike Sunder by Argo Fox, Creative Commons license. This has been the Test Coast Games podcast, Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License.